It's time to take flight once again. The entire coastline of Long Island and some areas inland are part of the Atlantic Flyway, the route that carries in total more than 500 bird species from the Arctic to tropical areas south, including the Caribbean. Sounds nice. Today, a flock of geese are hightailing it to warmer climes. The biannual migrations of countless bird species are essential to their health and development and shape the very nature of their bird lives. But some wild birds carry an unintended passenger, avian influenza.
And some of those viruses have undergone a mutation to make them highly lethal.
Distracted by the fear that one strain of bird flu, called H5N1, could become the next big pandemic in humans, we may have failed to take to heart the impact of the virus on the lives of birds. Since 2005, the number of wild and domesticated birds the virus has killed is greater than the combined human populations of the U.S. and Russia. And as the virus spreads through domesticated flocks, the actions taken to contain it can be devastating.
A gut-wrenching operation, having to see these animals one day and then they turn sick the next day, and then what hasn't turned sick or hasn't died on its own has to be depopulated.
Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Molly Bentley. In this episode, we consider the animals often left out of the story of avian influenza. We look at how the latest strain has found its way into creatures traveling by wing, hoof, and fin, and why it hasn't simply died out as it has in years past. Also, why, if vaccinating poultry could help stop the virus, why aren't we doing it? This episode is Flew the Coop. Here's another portrait of winged migration. Every spring and fall, in Colorado's San Luis Valley, just north of the New Mexico border, a cacophonous honking and wing-flapping spectacle unfolds. Hundreds of thousands of sandhill cranes claim the area as a pit stop during their long migrations. And although he lives in New Hampshire, ornithologist Scott Weidensahl tries never to miss the biannual migrations.
I have loved sandhill cranes for so long, and I have most often watched them on the Platte River in Nebraska, where there's like 600,000 that gather on their spring migration heading north back to the Arctic and subarctic to breed. And you don't so much watch cranes as hear cranes. I mean, there's such this trumpeting and bugling and croaking and the staccato.
Do you think you could do it? Could you imitate them?
It's sort of a... You get hundreds and thousands of them as they're taking off in the morning or coming back to their roost late in the day, and it's just magical and awe-inspiring.
It's a crucial spot for these stunning red-crowned, four-foot gray birds to refuel, rest, and socialize before continuing south along the Central and Pacific Flyway. Our feathered friends achieve incredible feats of endurance with each migratory journey. These inspiring flights teach us how a virus like avian influenza can travel long distances to infect diverse populations. Scientists estimate that H5N1 has infected more than 200 different species of birds in the U.S. since its 2021 arrival in North America. Determining an exact number of infections and deaths among wild birds is impossible because we can't catch and test every untamed animal. But some local outbreaks have been measured. For example, the state of Indiana recorded a dramatic die-off of more than 1,500 sandhill cranes in early 2025. But let's step back, look up, and consider the remarkable journeys undertaken by some migratory birds, what motivates a trip, and what's required by the animals to complete it. Never short of wonder in his accounts of what it's like to be a bird traveling along a flyway, Scott Weidensahl describes one of the major migratory routes, the East Asian-Australasian Flyway. It stretches from Alaska to the far east of Russia, south through East and Southeast Asia, to Australia and New Zealand.
Many shorebirds in particular that breed in Alaska and the Yukon follow this flyway south. So these are birds that are traveling like in a single nonstop flight, 6,000 miles from Australasia to a really crucial stopover point on the Yellow Sea between China and the Korean Peninsula. And for shorebirds in particular, like for example, one of them that comes from North America is the bar-tailed godwit, which has the longest single overwater flight of migration of any land bird on Earth. They leave the coast of Alaska and they fly 8,100 miles nonstop across the widest part of the Pacific Ocean to New Zealand and the coast of Australia. That takes them anywhere from 7 to 11 days of continuous powered flight. They're beating their wings the entire time. They can't rest on the water. They can't glide. They can't soar. They don't stop off on any of the islands in the South Pacific. They just kind of power through on this astounding migration. Did I mention the fact that they lose their digestive system before they make this flight?
You hadn't mentioned that, no. Go on.
minor little point here. Before they leave Alaska, having gained as much weight as they possibly can, their digestive system dramatically atrophies in a very short period of time. Their stomach, their intestines, to a lesser extent, their liver and kidney. They make the flight. They land in Australia, New Zealand. They regrow their guts. They feed through the winter. Come March and April, they balloon up in weight again. Their guts shrink down. They make the 6,000-mile flight to the Yellow Sea, regrow their guts, feed like idiots again, you know, just binge feeding. It's called hyperphagia. They just eat and eat and eat and eat and eat for days, double their weight once more, and then make another final 4,000 or 5,000-mile flight back to Alaska. So that's 18,000 miles a year on a bird that can live up to 25 or 30 years. So by the time a bar-tailed godwit dies, it will have flown the distance from here to the moon and most of the way back again.
But there's something even more extraordinary that they're doing it by themselves. It's a solo flight.
And imagine if you were a bar-tailed godwit chick doing this for the first time. You were hatched in the tundra of Western Alaska. Mom and dad left weeks earlier because they depart long before the juveniles do. So these birds take off, and they probably are departing as a flock of equally young teenage godwits, setting out on this incredible journey across the Pacific. And I have to wonder, and I don't know that this is necessarily anthropomorphism, what goes through their mind when they're on like day 6 and just pushing ahead over this limitless ocean. I mean, the Pacific is bigger than all the landmass on Earth put together. It's just an incomprehensibly large space to fly across. And I've often wondered, I mean, do they get exhausted? Do they get scared? Or do they just have this, are they powered by this certainty that they are doing what they must do, going where they must go, even though they don't know where that is?
Well, you've painted a rich picture of the kind of stamina that these migratory flights require. And Scott, given that it is such an enormous expenditure of energy, I mean, just losing your digestive system and growing it back alone probably requires a lot of energy. Why do they do it? What prompts migration?
Most migratory birds either depend on seasonally abundant food supplies or seasonally available habitats. So many of our, you know, just to take North America, many of our migratory birds are songbirds that feed predominantly on insects or fruit or nectar. And while there is some of that available in the Northern Hemisphere in the winter, there's not enough to feed the literally billions of birds that breed there during the summer. Or there are groups of birds like waterfowl that depend on open water. And of course, in the winter in the north, you know, if you're still sitting on a frozen lake in the wintertime, you are literally a sitting duck waiting for a coyote or a bobcat or something to find you. But we tend to think of migration backwards. We think of these as northern birds that are taking kind of a short winter vacation, when in many cases, these are inherently tropical birds that have colonized north during these what in the past at least were relatively rare interglacial periods when we didn't have miles thick sheets of ice occupying the northern hemisphere.
So birds that are flying on that East Asian, Australasian flyway stop at a feeding ground on the enormous mud flat on the Yellow Sea. I wonder if you've witnessed that feeding frenzy personally, or if you could give us, from your understanding, what that scene looks like and what those birds are doing.
Yes. In fact, in the spring of 2018, I spent some time on the Yellow Sea when I was working on my book, A World on the Wing, because, as you say, it's one of the most important migratory stopover points in the world. You know, we're talking here about something like 11 to 13 million migratory shorebirds that fan out over more than half of the Earth's surface on their breeding grounds. So it's of enormous importance to dozens and dozens of species of shorebirds, including some of the most critically endangered birds on the planet, like the spoon-billed sandpiper. It only numbers a few hundred birds. They breed in the Russian Far East in winter in Southeast Asia. And without the Yellow Sea, they die. They go away. And in fact, we've seen cases where when large areas of the mudflats along the Yellow Sea have been destroyed, the populations of birds that depended on them disappeared.
Let's say more about what this cantina looks like there on the mudflat, because pictures of it, you would think, okay, this is just a featureless gray flat of mud. I don't know where they're going to find food. Paint us a picture, if you will, of what it's like to dine on this mudflat.
Well, as the tide starts to go out, these birds move from their high tide roosts inland, where they have to take refuge when the tide comes in completely. And it's just wave after wave after wave of these birds flying overhead, flying quite low overhead. They're often passing sometimes just a few yards over your head, and it's by the thousands and then sometimes by the tens of thousands. And they hit the mud, and with absolutely no preamble, begin plunging their beaks down into the mud, looking for these tiny little mollusks and marine invertebrates and polychaete worms and other things that and the mud really does look featureless on the surface. You wouldn't think there's anything there, but the birds know that there is plenty under there. And so do the people, because these tidal flats are incredibly important to coastal residents in China and South Korea that have for generations, for probably hundreds of generations, depended on them for shellfish and other sources of food. So you have both the people and the birds out on these precious, precious remaining tidal flats, looking for the same thing, looking for the same resources.
And you've said this, or at least you've implied it, but could you say directly why these stopover places are vital to a bird's health and well-being?
Without these stopover points, these birds don't have enough food, they don't have enough energy to make these hemispheric migrations. The only way that these truly amazing long-distance migrations can occur is if the birds have plenty of food at each end of the journey and at these crucial stopover sites in between, places like the Yellow Sea, where they can stop, rest, refuel, regain their energy, and then carry on. Because many of these shorebirds that are passing through the Yellow Sea are going to be heading up into the Arctic to breed, and they're going to arrive in the Arctic when things are still frozen, when there's not a lot of food there. So they're going to need that full fuel tank in order to get through those first weeks on the breeding grounds, when they're setting up a territory and finding a mate and starting the process of nesting.
Well, we're talking about just one migratory path here. Of course, there are many paths of migratory birds around the world. And it strikes me that in total, they create a kind of invisible stitching of the world. And if we were above the Earth, Scott, and those routes were made visible, the way that ocean currents are in maps of the world's oceans, what would that full picture look like?
Well, it would actually be hard to pick out any individual route, because it's just migration is so ubiquitous. It covers almost every square meter of every part of the Earth. Maybe not the center of the Antarctic Peninsula, but even there you've got penguins walking long distances on their seasonal breeding migrations. But the thing is, we don't even have to imagine what it looks like. We have tracking data now from so many species of migratory birds, and you layer all that together, you can see how they're following wind patterns and ocean currents and coastlines and mountain ridges, the way that they are shaping their migrations to the physical environment around them, and doing these astonishing loop-de-loops. I mean, Arctic terns crisscrossing the Atlantic and the Pacific, tens of thousands of miles, a single Arctic tern traveling 61,000 miles in the course of the year from the coast of Maine to the Indian Ocean and back again, and zooming at one point close to the coast of South America, and then a few weeks later off the coast of Africa, and then looping back into the North Atlantic off Cape Cod. It's to have this window into bird migration to the extent that we do now really feels like such a privilege, and evokes, at least in me, it evokes such a sense of awe, the notion that these are tiny animals, many of them barely heavier than air, that are traveling thousands of miles on the strength of their own muscles and their own sinew, and doing this, up to this point, largely out of sight of humans.
Well, let's talk now a bit about avian flu. In your observation of wild birds and in your studies, what have you noticed about the effects of avian flu on these birds?
It's been bad. One of the species I study along with colleagues of mine are snowy owls. And snowy owls, everybody thinks they feed on lemmings, which is true in the summertime up in the Arctic. But often, especially here in New England where I live, along the coast in the winter, they feed very heavily on waterfowl. And so we've seen many, many snowy owls in the last three winters dying of avian influenza that they've picked up from sick and dying waterfowl. And given the fact that we now know that there are only probably somewhere between 14,000 and 28,000 snowy owls in the world, it's a relatively small population, we may be looking at population-level impacts on species like snowy owl. Certainly, we've seen continental population-level impacts on species like peregrine falcons, which have seen kind of significant drop-offs since avian influenza hit. Regional losses in bald eagles, especially along the southeast coast the first year or two that the epidemic hit. Colonial seabirds, especially in the North Sea, have taken a tremendous hit. I should also stress that we're talking about its impact on wild birds, and we often hear that wild birds are carriers of avian influenza, but they're generally not the progenitors of these new avian influenza strains. They are as much victims as anybody else here.
Well, finally, Scott, I think you are someone, I'm fairly certain you're someone who would wish that wild birds were in the news for a reason other than within this context of avian flu, partly because they've been maligned, but partly because these birds are sick and they're dying, and we wish that weren't the case. I wonder if you could leave us with some thoughts about how wild birds are more than vectors of a virus. And from a big picture point of view, what do they add to the world?
Part of me rebels a little bit about having to have birds justify themselves. I mean, that's sort of what I'm stuck with. You know, birds have as much right to this planet as we do. And what they bring to our lives and the ways they enrich our lives, they do while they're living their own lives that they have every right to as much as we do. They deserve a functioning planet as much as we do. And the thing is, if we have a planet that works for birds, it's a planet that'll work for everything, including us. If we can find a way to have migratory bird populations that are healthy, all the rest will take care of itself, because they occupy every corner of the world and require such an interlocking, functioning planet. If we can save the world for birds, we will save the world for us.
Scott Wiedenthal is an ornithologist and the author of A World on the Wing, The Global Odyssey of Migratory Birds. Next, why the asymptomatic spread of H5N1 among birds has allowed the virus to move silently from migrating wild birds to poultry and into other animals.
When the virus moved from North America into Central America and then moved on down into South America, there began to be infections noticed in sea lions.
And later in the episode, if poultry vaccines can help curb the virus, why aren't we using them? This episode of Big Picture Science is called Flew the Coop.
When you give to a nonprofit, how do you measure success? You'll hear a lot about things like low overhead costs and efficient fundraising, but what about the actual impact on people's lives? GiveWell, this episode's sponsor, focuses on that impact. They've spent more than 70,000 hours on research to help donors fund highly cost-effective programs that save or improve lives the most per dollar. GiveWell has spent 18 years researching global health and poverty alleviation and only directs funding to the highest impact opportunities they've found. And over 150,000 donors have already trusted GiveWell to give more than $2.5 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save over 300,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. You can find all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. And thanks to the donors who chose to sponsor their research, GiveWell doesn't take a cut from your tax-deductible donation to their recommended funds. If this is your first gift through GiveWell, you can have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year, or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick Podcast and enter Big Picture Science at checkout. Make sure they know that you heard about GiveWell from Big Picture Science to get your donation matched. Again, that's GiveWell.org, code Big Picture Science, to donate or find out more.
By hitching a ride inside migrating birds and circling the globe, H5N1 has had time and opportunity to mingle and mutate to become better at transmission. Pathobiologist and contributor Sikhan Akbon has been helping us track the outbreak. So we turn to you, Sikhan. What is notable about it?
Well, Molly, the virus has figured out how to avoid killing some of its carriers long enough to find a way into new species of birds and mammals. So coyotes, seals, raccoons, cows. And to do that from country to country, it takes advantage of a few common places. I met up with producer Brian Edwards to tour one of them.
We're standing outside of a live bird market. We're about 2 blocks from where you live?
A little further, about a mile away, I'd say, but pretty close, yeah.
You're walking in front of it, you're just going to see, you know, a pretty standard red brick two-story building in Brooklyn. Although there's a giant sign with different types of poultry and cows and chickens and goats on the side of it.
I actually came across this place. I was just biking down in this area, not too far from my apartment. And we'd been reporting on this story and looking for a live bird farm and just this giant billboard on the side of the building in an otherwise pretty nondescript industrial neighborhood just kind of popped out. I am surrounded by, you know, cages 10 deep, essentially. There's two rows. There are chickens all around me, some sticking their heads out of the cage to say hi.
Early in 2025, the state temporarily shut down some live bird markets after a few tested positive for H5N1 influenza, but later the markets were allowed to reopen.
So we've got all kinds here too. We've got some like white, fluffy looking chickens here. We've got kind of some like brown, the stereotypical ones I think you would see on a farm. We've got black and white ducks below them. Truly, I can't even count the amount of birds that are in here.
Live bird markets like this exist in cities and towns all over the world. They carry heavy cultural significance in places like China, and they're a testament to the modern demands of trying to feed big populations. You know, all those mouths need a lot of protein. You know, really, raising chickens and turkeys in tight, dense quarters of markets or poultry farms reveals how flu strains like H5N1 are the Achilles heel for domesticated birds.
And I'm literally seeing a pigeon on the ground right in front of us. I saw one in there while we were in there that flew out, and that's kind of the way that it goes, right?
Yeah, so that's the thing with the markets like this. You're going to get birds from the outside, wild birds, like, fly in, and if they have bird flu, it's going to be in their guts, and they're gonna poop it out, and that's going to get maybe into the feed of the birds that are in the cage, and then they'll catch it that way, too. And yeah, this just kind of looks like a standard, like, grocery store market that you might see in any city in the world.
Except they have live birds.
And goats in the basement. So you're definitely going to, because we were walking in there, when we were walking in there, there was just sort of like puddles of, I would say, like bird poop and water and like feed. And that also is kind of a place where like you might see like germs and viruses accumulate. So you're definitely going to want to wipe down your shoes with like some Clorox. I'm going to do the same.
That's a great tip that I would not have thought of. So I'm definitely going to do that when I get home.
Maybe with some gloves on.
Good thing I didn't wear open-toed sandals today.
No, don't do that. Don't wear Crocs in a live bird market.
Lessons learned.
Sikhan, my attention is drawn to that loose pigeon. Now, we don't mean to imply that that particular pigeon was carrying H5N1, but its presence is an example of how the virus could have an opportunity to jump from a wild bird species to a domesticated one.
Exactly. While the role farms and live markets play is clear to us now, it wasn't always. One of the world's most prominent bird flu scientists, veterinarian David Swain, has studied the routes that H5N1 has taken to reach where it is now. He will help us understand the roles that wild bird migration, farms, and poultry markets have played in allowing strains of bird flu to evolve from not causing much disease to becoming very severe for animals. It's what scientists call going from low path to high path.
Low path being low pathogenic.
Exactly.
all highly pathogenic avian influenza viruses are derived from a low-path avian influenza virus. And some of those viruses have undergone a mutation to make them highly lethal. And usually that mutation occurs when they move from the wild waterfowl reservoir of low path into domestic poultry.
Dr. Swain says that the virus behind our current outbreak is an H5N1 strain that had its origins on a goose farm in rural China more than 30 years ago.
The first virus was identified in 1996 of this high path lineage, and it was isolated in a domestic goose in Guangdong, China in 1996. We know over 600 million birds have been depopulated and over 50 million have died from this one kind of virus lineage that started with that 1996 first flock.
A few months later, doctors found the first human infection not far away in Hong Kong after a three-year-old boy died. By the end of 1997, another 17 people had become ill and five more died. The virus had made its way from a rural farm to an urban center. But the puzzle was, how had the virus jumped from domestic poultry to humans?
Two different species.
That's right. Through epidemiological detective work, scientists discovered a common thread among those who got sick. Most had visited a live poultry market a week before their symptoms sprouted.
Most people know that Hong Kong outbreak was kind of the first big event where we had, you know, human infections with mortality, with death. And that was sort of new for avian influenza. There have been a few avian influenza infections in the past that were usually pretty mild. People recovered, but this was really the first one where you had a significant number of people with mortality, really severe disease with that occurrence. And that highlighted for the first time the concept of a live poultry market that is present in multiple countries around the world.
Flu viruses mutate naturally and often, so much so that a variant you find in one wild bird, say a duck, will be slightly different than one being carried by a migrating goose.
So what happens when that duck and that goose interact?
When that happens, the two different flu variants can exchange large portions of genetic code, which is called reassortment. By doing so, they can pick up new traits. Dr. Swain says that a low-path flu strain can become remarkably better at spreading, or more severe, the longer it circulates and jumps between species. But what's interesting is that a bird flu strain is called low-path or high-path based solely on what it does to chickens. That's because high pathogenic bird flu is a death sentence for chickens.
If you have a population of chickens and you infect them with a high-path virus, it'll go through that whole flock and kill near almost 100% of the birds. So there are very, very few survivors in a flock.
Of course, we humans worry what happens if one of those strains ever comes for us. But people don't often realize how lethal it is for infected chickens.
Now, when it becomes a high-path virus, then that virus very quickly spreads from those epithelial cells in that respiratory GI tract, and it goes in the bloodstream and produces what we call a viremia, spreads throughout the body, basically causing death of the blood vessels. That's one type of lesion. The second type of lesion is the virus itself then will infect almost every organ in the body. And so you'll have big areas of the heart that are affected, kills those heart cells, so then they can't contract. What you may see in the very early stage of the infection, you just walk out there and you have dead birds. There are no sick birds, they just die. You don't see anything because it happens so quickly and it affects the vascular system that the circulatory system collapses and they basically fall over dead.
It almost sounds like Ebola for humans. Is that a fair comparison?
Yeah, some of the clinical and lesion observations, which is the vascular changes and the hemorrhages, yes, that's kind of similar to what Ebola can do in humans. Of course, there are two different kinds of viruses, but they have a similar mechanism of that vascular change.
What we're hearing is that soon after H5N1 hit China in the late 1990s, scientists identified farms and live poultry markets as potential hotspots of disease. Sikon, how does this connect to what's happening in the United States today?
So it's the same overall strain of H5N1, but like a tree, it's been growing branches. Some branches, or clades, can be devastating depending on their traits. The 1997 outbreak in Hong Kong required the elimination of all animals in the area's poultry markets and chicken farms, about 1.5 million birds.
Goodness.
Truly awful. This stamping out, as it's called, seemed to have solved the problem of that first outbreak in Hong Kong. But as the new millennium arrived, scientists sporadically detected H5N1 in wild Chinese waterfowl.
By 2002 in Hong Kong, they started finding mortality, especially among varieties of ducks, different duck species. And so that's kind of the first kind of evidence that this virus was not just a virus affecting poultry and causing some human infections, but there also was this virus, the first evidence of it infecting more diverse bird species. And that kind of began, I think, the beginning of, you know, how this virus was going to continue to evolve. And by that evolution of it, adapt to new species causing infections and illness and even in death. And that was, I think, probably the pivotal event that showed this virus then could be moved via migratory birds.
It turned out that killing poultry in farms and markets only stopped local transmission of the virus. Scientists discovered that it continued to circulate in wild birds. They also started to find that some species of those birds tolerate H5N1 without becoming too sick to migrate, mallards and other ducks in particular. This adaptation of the virus has an advantage by keeping its host alive long enough to hitch a ride across borders. Dr. Swain says that over the decades that scientists have tracked H5N1, they've recorded it making at least 5 major transcontinental leaps, from China to Turkey and Egypt, from East Asia to Europe. The Americas first experienced H5N1 with the 3rd transcontinental movement starting in 2014.
When it came around, that was the movement of the virus across the Pacific Ocean, down into Canada, and then down into the United States on the Pacific Flyway. This virus had changed, and I'll use the word adapted, better to chickens and turkeys. But once it got established in the Midwest and you started having multiple cases pop up in Minnesota and Iowa, that virus had adapted enough that the amount that it required to have an infection and make it easier to transmit really dropped down. That was probably what was responsible for it moving farm to farm.
By 2015, H5N1 had an easier time spreading through chickens, but it sounds like it still wasn't the menace that we see today.
That's right. The turning point came in 2020. Mixing strains popped out a variant of H5N1 that quickly became the dominant version of bird flu in the world.
That is the variant that is causing the problems today.
Yes, its name is a string of numbers, 2344B. This clade of H5N1 has shown even greater agility jumping between animal hosts. A few years ago, it made its own transcontinental flight from Europe into North America.
Somewhere in 2020, and that could have been in Africa, maybe in Egypt, a low-path virus reassorted with this H5N8 high-path virus, and what came out was an H5N1 virus, most immediate predecessor to what we have. And then in 2021, that virus came across the Atlantic. Instead of the Pacific, it's the Atlantic it came across, with the first cases identified in Canada from samples collected in November 2021. That was in a great black-backed gull. And then in December, in a backyard farm, a small farm, I should say, in St. John's, Newfoundland. And that was the first cases in early December.
Some migrating birds have been spared a devastating illness, but others have not been so lucky.
I'll give you an example. So northern gannets are a seabird. And in 2023, there was major die-offs in gannet colonies in the North Sea, so off the coast of Great Britain. And in some of these colonies, it really just kind of wiped out the colony. We're talking about tens of 20,000s of birds that died from this infection. So that has had a huge impact on them. So it's going to take probably many, many years for, the colonies of northern gannets in the North Sea to recover from this ecological disaster, really is what it is. But it doesn't end there with birds. It also, then we're talking about mammals. We're talking about wild mammals. Early in 2022, probably about April, May, there were diagnoses of infections in red foxes. And that has become the predominant carnivorous wild mammal that has been affected. That is until we started finding, and this is not me personally, but infections in other mammal species. And I think our first premonition of this was in 2022, and this is in the state of Maine, but also in Canada in the St. Lawrence Seaway, of finding harbor seals that were dead. So that was kind of the beginning premonition, but it really got worse because when the virus moved from North America into Central America and then moved on down into South America in 2023, there began to be infections noticed in Peru off the coast of the Pacific coast of sea lions.
And Molly, you went to visit a colony of sea lions on the Pacific coast.
I did.
Walking up to Pier 39 in San Francisco, you can hear and smell the sea lions before you see them. Today, about 100 of these large pinnipeds are sunning themselves on rafts off the pier here, occasionally flipping over to expose their big bellies or splashing back into the bay. There is no evidence that H5N1 avian flu has struck San Francisco sea lions, but animals across South American beaches have not been so lucky. 2 years ago, at least 24,000 sea lions died across Peru, Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil, where the cacophony of sea lions barking and the pups crying for their moms went silent. Elephant seals died by the thousands, too. Little is known about how H5N1 spreads through these water-loving mammals, but the outbreak tells us how bad things can get when the virus invades a new species.
What's really kind of changed is that we now have seen, you know, this H5N1, 2344B virus infect a wide variety of species and large numbers of these species. So that increases the chances of an exposure event to a variety of mammals. Now, if you're a fox, you may be unfortunate to be that one fox that finds a dead bird and eats it and all the other foxes didn't. But if you're in a colony like these sea lions where you're a lot of sea lions together and a lot of seabirds are feeding together, it has a better opportunity or chance for transmission.
So in summary, the virus that first emerged on a rural farm in southern China in 1996, it's branched, it's changed, its variants recombining, and now we have this massive outbreak all over the world with more than 500 bird species affected. I want to thank veterinarian David Swain for sharing his expertise with us.
Next, stories about containing the virus, the difficult steps farmers have to take when bird flu is detected, and the promise of poultry vaccines. We have them. Why aren't we using them? This episode of Big Picture Science, looking at how avian influenza is affecting birds and other animals, is called Flu the Coop.
So you're going to open this door?
Ready?
Yeah, I think I'm ready.
Well, here you go.
That's a lot of ducks. What kind of ducks are they? They're
white,
beautiful.
They're white pekin ducks.
White pekin ducks. How many ducks are in there?
Well, you saw one pen. That one pen has about 600 ducks. The whole building probably has about 2,000 ducks.
I wonder if we could get your name and your title, how you like to be identified, and what you do here.
I'm Doug Corwin. I'm just a fourth generation owner of Crescent Duck Farm. Great-grandfather started in 1908, and I basically oversee 70 or so people breeding, hatching, growing, making feed for ducks. You can see that I'm in rubber boots, I'm in work clothes, I do a little bit of everything.
A poultry farm can lie far off a main road, be enclosed by a fence, its flocks confined to barns, but avian influenza can still find a way in. Wild birds and rats can bring it, but so can contaminated water, farm equipment, manure, clothing, and shoes. Poultry farmers live with the fear of detection of this highly contagious virus, which prompts a dreaded but necessary visit from the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, or APHIS.
Now, you had 100,000 ducks before they got infected. Can you just tell us what alerted you to the possible infection with avian influenza? How did it come to your attention?
I just saw a flock that overnight turned extremely sick. Some dead ones, some morbid ones, some very lackadaisical ones. And as soon as I saw that, I called Cornell and said, I've never seen anything like this. Please come down. We want to take some samples and get this checked out.
You called Cornell University.
Correct.
Why?
Why? Because they have a veterinary program that specializes in ducks and poultry, and they're the main resource in this region.
Ducks do get sick for various reasons. Did this look like something new to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm 66. I've been here all my life. I've seen a lot of different things, but I never saw what I saw in January. The rapid spread, the rapid sickness, it just didn't seem right. I was hoping against hope it might have been something else. But I knew that there was no way that if it was avian flu that we could continue on the way we were.
So, Doug, what happened next, and how quickly did things move? Because I get the sense that things moved at a pretty quick pace.
Well, I had Cornell Hiller on a Wednesday. They dragged the samples up to Ithaca. Thursday, they made the positive diagnosis, which alerted everything. And come Friday, I had APHIS and New York State Ag and Markets here. Since we knew it was avian flu, everything here on the farm had to be documented, inventoried. That was Friday. as of Monday, they had 15 or so people from government, from New York State, from USDA, and they brought in 30 or so contractors to use their plan to euthanize everything on the farm with the help of our employees here.
What strikes me about this, and when we talked prior to this interview, is that you didn't have a decision to make once it's detected. It's not as though this was a difficult decision to make. It was a difficult experience, but there was no decision on your part.
There was no way that I could have hid this, and there's no way I would have wanted to ethically. This is right now the current policy. I had wished that we had a different policy where we could have been allowed to vaccinate or do something different, but given the fact that it is so virulent, so transmissible to poultry, it's a health concern that we had to be depopulated.
You're explaining this because these are the regulations, but I can only imagine, even if it wasn't a decision, how difficult this must have been for you.
Yeah, the combined difficulty of knowing that everything stopped all at once, but then also having to lay off a huge, huge number of employees, and that was comparable to losing a parent. It really, really was a hard, hard experience. And a gut-wrenching operation, having to see these animals one day and then they turn sick the next day, and then what hasn't turned sick or hasn't died on its own has to be depopulated. And we let these contracting crews do the worst of it, but then we're still left with all the mortality that had to be carried out of these barns, had to be put in a payloader bucket, had to be put in a compost building. Just an ugly, sad experience.
And one that was new to you in all your decades of being a duck farmer.
Never. I've heard of such things. I've seen pictures of such things, but I've never seen anything as deadly, as transmissible. Well, transmissible is moving as fast from barn to barn to barn, almost overnight.
Now, those ducks sound pretty lively, and they look healthy. How is your recovery going?
Well, we seem to be making four steps forward and two steps backwards, but we're getting there. I mean, I'm optimistic. I'm stoical about this, but we're getting there. I knew it was going to be a long, long process.
And you were able to save some duck eggs, and that's how the lineage has continued?
That is correct. I mean, we were lucky that USDA and New York State allowed us to wash and to get some very old eggs off the premises, and we were able to find the ways of hatching those and growing them out elsewhere to bring them back to give us what we feel we need to continue on.
You mentioned vaccination. Was vaccinating your ducks for avian flu an option? Because I know you vaccinate them for other diseases, and will it be an option in the future?
Well, it is illegal for me to use an avian flu vaccine. It is not allowed in this country for us to use a vaccine. Will it be an option in the future? I certainly hope so, but the current political climate doesn't seem to be allowing such.
What does the follow-up procedure look like at this point? Does someone come out from USDA or APHIS to retest the animals, retest the birds? So what happens next?
Well, the follow-up's already occurred. We sanitize these barns. All of these barns were tested in 25 spots. They were swabbed in various locations all around. And believe me, I was there. I made sure we got every crack and crevice to make sure there was no avian flu. Plus, once I brought the birds back, I had to take fecal swabs of 35 birds from each flock for three consecutive weeks and send them away. So this farm has been declared avian flu free.
When you say every crevice, I can imagine there are a lot of crevices in these barns.
Yeah, well, and
they're big barns.
And believe me, I made sure that we did the worst of the worst and whatnot, but not that we hadn't spent 3 months cleaning these barns before that, but you never know. I mean, it's hard to clean every last little crack.
Do you feel like you're out of the woods? And is there a point when you would feel that you're out of the woods when it comes to this strain of avian influenza?
No, we're playing Russian roulette right now. This disease is rampant right now in the Midwest, on the West Coast, up in Canada. It's been going on season after season after season for the last 4 years. I think we know some steps to help us lower our chances in the future, but I don't think we're risk-free or out of the woods by any scope of the imagination.
Well, good luck. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Doug Corwin is a duck farmer and the owner of Crescent Duck Farm in Aquabog, New York.
My name's John Cohen. I'm a senior correspondent with Science Magazine, and my new book is Planning Miracles: How to Prevent Future Pandemics.
John Cohen has written extensively about infectious diseases and under what conditions they can lead to epidemics and pandemics. He's been reporting on the spread of H5N1 and our attempts to contain it, including updates on the state of poultry vaccines, the type that Doug Corwin wishes were available to his flock.
So the way that this has worked in the past is there's been an avian influenza virus gets into poultry from wild birds. We cull the birds. This happened in 2015, 2016. Virus goes away. H5N1 has flipped all this on its head. This version of H5N1 has been around since 2020, and it keeps coming back. So it's a really weird virus that isn't succumbing to culling the way that previous ones did.
Help us understand why it's not been so effective this time.
Yeah, and that's a fascinating question. And in the past, wild birds have become immune to variants that cause harm. So these migratory birds get, let's say, an H5N1, and it burns out. It doesn't stick around because of immunity. This one, for reasons that are baffling, just hasn't allowed the wild birds to develop an immunity that gets rid of it. And, you know, they're also having newborns that don't have any immunity. So there's something in the cycle that's gone off kilter, and it's been spreading to sea mammals and other species that are bringing it back to the birds. So there are cyclic events that are happening that are unusual, and it's a perplexing situation.
But does that answer the question of why the culling of domestic flocks doesn't seem to be as effective?
Sure, because the migratory birds keep bringing it back. If it burned out in the migratory birds and you culled birds in the season that they're in the region, when the migratory birds returned, the virus wouldn't return. So it's those migratory patterns that the virus is piggybacking on.
John, do you think the public has a solid sense of the loss of life here among poultry and other animals?
No. And since this particular variant has entered the United States in 2022, we have culled more than 180 million poultry in the United States. It's an enormous economic loss to the farms, and it's really hard for them to recover, even with government subsidies and help. And it's a lot of birds that are dying because of the virus or fear of the virus. It's really dangerous to these birds.
Well, let's look at another option for containing avian influenza, which is vaccination. John, how many poultry vaccines are in development or in use right now, and how do they work? I know that's a two-part question, but first, introduce us to the subject of poultry vaccination.
The bottom line is vaccines protect birds the same way they protect humans. They prevent them from developing severe disease, and they also lower the amount of virus in birds that get infected. So in a community, there is a lower level of virus around. And in China, what they do, if you have 10 barns with 50,000 chickens in every barn, and one barn has the virus, and you've vaccinated all your birds, you're required to cull the birds in the one barn, but you don't have to touch the other 9 barns on your farm. Now, in the United States, if you have 10 barns and one bird in one barn is infected, you cull all 10 barns. So a lot of scientists at the frontier in the United States and Europe are saying, China's got this right. Let's learn from them. Let's do what they do.
Help us picture how you vaccinate poultry. I mean, we all know how we get vaccinations, the shot in the arm. How does it work with birds?
Poultries get a dozen vaccines right now. They get a lot of vaccines. Some vaccines are put into their feed. Some they have a vaccine gun that just you can boom, 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 inject, you know, thousands of birds in a day. There are different ways to provide vaccines, but they're routinely used on poultry farms. Now, poultry farms can have more than 1 million chickens. They can have enormous numbers of birds. One of the quandaries here is there are two types of poultry. There are layers that give us eggs, and then there are broilers where we eat the meat. Broilers only live for a few months before they are harvested for their meat. The economic incentive for a broiler farm to vaccinate is less than the economic incentive for a layer farm that keeps birds for over a year. So there's a division in the industry in the United States between layers who want to vaccinate and broilers who don't. And that's part of the problem too.
Are you saying that everything is sort of stalled, that we may have a solution or a powerful tool in vaccination of these animals, and we're not employing it to the, you know, to the greatest effect in this case?
Are you shocked that science isn't carrying the day? Science is not carrying the day. This is not driven by scientific arguments or public health arguments. It's driven by industry and trade, not science. The scientific arguments against vaccinating by most scientists in the field don't make sense.
Let me ask you a science question then. Now, I understand in some of these vaccines, they may not be designed for one variant, such as H5N1, but they might be designed for another variant. How does a vaccine work in that case when you design it for one variant, but it actually still provides some immunity against another one?
So let's go to the details of what the H and the N mean.
Oh, good. I love this part.
That's what it comes down to. H is hemagglutinin, N is neuraminidase. These are surface proteins on the virus. Vaccines are designed to create antibodies against hemagglutinin. That's the main thing they're designed to do. They also create antibodies to neuraminidase. And there's some evidence that neuraminidase antibodies are even more important to protect. But the standard that we use in the United States when we evaluate a new flu vaccine is we look at antibodies against the H. That's what we care about. So if you have an H5, forget about the N. It will work to some degree against all H5s. Now, the virus that's been going around since 2020, and I'm going to give you an alphabet soup here, is 2344B, which is a variant of H5. And the best vaccine against 2344B is a vaccine made from 2344B. But other H5 vaccines will have some impact that's positive. And even if the N is different, they will still work to some degree. So when you get into questions about protecting humans and building a stockpile of these vaccines, there are some scientists who say, hey, an H5 vaccine in our stockpile that's been around is good. And there are others who say, come on, make a 2344B. You know, get up to speed.
Could you make a vaccine for humans and also give it to poultry? And could a human take a poultry vaccine? Why not just make a vaccine for all animals? After all, humans are animals.
So we don't mix human and animal vaccines. In theory, you could, but the reason we don't is because of safety. The standards for animal vaccines in terms of safety are lower for good reason. We are really, really concerned about even mild, what some would consider mild side effects from human vaccines. With animals, we have more leeway about the side effects that occur. So there's a good solid reason that we don't just put animal vaccines into our bodies. Then again, I want to throw you a curve. The first vaccine ever to prove itself in humans was a cowpox virus that worked against smallpox. That is why they're called vaccines. The word vacca in Latin is cow. So we used an animal virus to protect us from a human virus. And smallpox virus only infects humans. So there is a blurring of the lines there that is a bit poetic. And I just wanted to underscore that though we don't use animal vaccines, we have used things from animals to make our vaccines.
Well, we've been talking about the effect of avian influenza on birds and mammals in this episode because their experiences are often left out of the reports about the virus in favor of the human pandemic threat. But let me ask you now, John, what is that threat and what mutation would H5N1 have to acquire to be a threat to humans?
H5N1 doesn't move easily between humans right now. So it would need to acquire mutations that allowed it to transmit better. Most all the human infections are occurring in people who are working with animals or live with animals and are very close to them. And they get high doses of virus when those animals are sick. If the virus figures out a way, evolves a way to more easily move between humans, it could be incredibly devastating. The three largest pandemics we faced in the last century were all influenza viruses. Some believe those were all avian flu viruses that got into humans. So once that virus gets into mammalian species like cows and has a lot of chance to replicate, lots of opportunity, it has more opportunities to do its little genetic tricks to make variants that are just by happenstance, better at moving between mammals. And that's when we're in deep, deep trouble. There's something I want to underscore here. These are not difficult vaccines to make. This isn't like HIV, where we have worked for decades to try to make an HIV vaccine. And there is not an HIV vaccine because that virus is incredibly difficult to stop with an immune response. Flu viruses aren't difficult to stop with immune responses. It's a pretty straightforward thing. We know how to do it. And the vaccines we use today in animals and in humans against flu have a long track record of saving lives and preventing disease.
Well, finally, John, I think you hinted at this, but I'm going to ask this question. It has to do with funding and federal support. And many areas of scientific research have suffered from cuts to their federal funding. But it looks like when it comes to H5N1, there seem to be two trends. One is that the Department of Health and Human Services announced that hundreds of millions of dollars had been dedicated to the surveillance of the virus. But on the other hand, we have funding for the CDC that's been slashed, and a human vaccine development program for H5N1 was canceled. So it sounds like federal funding to keep H5N1 at bay is at the best a mixed bag. And I'm wondering, how does that affect our ability to control this virus?
In a recent Science story, I took a close look at what the U.S. government was doing for pandemic preparedness since Donald Trump started his second term in office, called the Pandemic Next Time. That looks closely at what the Trump administration has done. And it essentially has eviscerated a lot of pandemic preparedness funding. It cut Moderna's funding of $766 million for H5N1 vaccines to protect humans. It has stalled approval of an H5N1 vaccine for poultry. It has done away with the largest surveillance network the United States had for different emerging pathogens. And a president wrote an executive order that pulled out of the World Health Organization on day one of his taking office for his second term. And WHO leads the largest flu surveillance network in the world. So we have taken a giant step backward in terms of protecting ourselves from emerging flu variants that are going to be more difficult to detect without the help of the United States, and from developing vaccines to protect us when they do emerge.
So in this case, these animals are almost literally a flock of canaries in the coal mine.
Well, you know, how do you weigh risk? That's what it comes down to. Are these animals with H5N1 a risk to humans? Of course they are. Is it certain that it's going to happen and trigger a pandemic? Of course not, because just not how things work. Is there going to be another pandemic in my lifetime? I expect there will be. Will it be influenza? That's at the top of the list of worries, but it's about precaution. It's about an ounce of prevention and a pound of cure. And Mike Osterholm, an epidemiologist in the United States, says, why does every airport have a fire station? Is it because planes are crashing all the time and we need to put out fires? Of course not. It's precautionary. And we as humans have a long history of being really bad at prevention.
John Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
That's my great pleasure. Thank you.
John Cohen is a senior correspondent with Science Magazine, and he is the author of Planning Miracles: How to Prevent Future Pandemics. And you'll find a link to his articles on our website, bigpicturescience.org. And Sikhan, we bring you back for the big picture view of this episode. So while we've been telling the story of the animals that are affected by this virus, and we'll say that humans are animals too, it's also a story about a virus and how adaptive it is.
H5N1 is a case study, a really valuable case study, in that it's really taking advantage of how humanity operates, right? We need these farms, we need these markets in order to feed ourselves. And it is sort of wormed its way in and then found a way to thrive on these farms, move to wild birds, travel along with wild birds over borders across the world, get back on these farms, and then get into even other species. And so it's a really interesting case study and adaptation.
So, Sikon, this is a story, I mean, much like the virus itself, this is a story that is constantly changing. If someone wants an update on what is happening to birds, what the potential is for human cases, I think you have a website. It's one that you run that you might direct them to. What is that?
That's right. Think Global Health. It's a publication out of the Council on Foreign Relations, and I'm the managing editor. And we're following the twists and turns of H5N1.
So that website is thinkglobalhealth.org, and you can find a link on our website to that, too. This show is made possible thanks to producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards, and contributor Sikon Akbon. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. We also give big thanks to our listeners and our Patreon supporters. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. This episode of Big Picture Science that looks at why avian influenza so efficiently spreads to birds and other animals is called Flew the Coop.